Okay, Sean Campbell, absent. Ellen Campos?
Here.
Martha Dexter?
Here.
Nancy Girt?
Here.
Barbara Gorson?
Here.
Cindy Jackson?
Here.
And Deb Tracy Crew, absent.
Our next agenda item is adoption of the agenda.
I move to adopt.
Second. Any discussion? And all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? No. Oral communications. This is the opportunity for anyone who is here with us tonight in the audience to address the commission on matters that are on or off the agenda. It says here, I thought it was off the agenda, but within the commission's jurisdiction. Any comments from the audience tonight before we get started? Okay, seeing none. Report by the library director who tonight is represented by Janice.
I just have a few exciting things to tell you. One of them is our third regional manager started work today. She did not leave the office three, so I think she'll be back tomorrow. Her name is Jessica Goodman, and we stole her from Palo Alto Public Library. And she, her geographic area will be downtown Grand Sephora and Garfield Park. So she's running to catch up, and we're very excited to finally have her with us. The other thing that's happening right now is we are in the process of going through the applications that we received for the Downtown Branch Advisory Committee. For the Downtown Branch, we received 19 applications, and so we are going through those, and we hope to have a decision fairly soon, maybe even next week, once we work through everything. And whatever the third one was, it just sort of left my brain. But I'm sure it'll come back at some opportune time. So that's my report.
Any member reports?
I can just report that Capitola City Council this Thursday will be reviewing and hopefully approving the schematic designs from the architect. They'll also be discussing naming rights. We're not going to be approving anything. We just need to get a discussion out as to philosophically where the city council stand on naming rights.
This is consistent with what the board is doing.
Yes, consistent with what the board is doing. Yeah.
Any other reports? Okay, then, moving on to the consent calendar. We have a motion to accept consent.
Second.
Any discussion on that? All right, all in favor?
Aye.
All right. The general business is we have one topic tonight, homeless issues at the library, and I'm going to turn this over to Janice to open, to give us the background.
And we have some wonderful presentations. Mm-hmm. So this is the first of a series of presentations we are going to make in various services and programs that the library is offering. And tonight we are talking about the kinds of services we offer to people without homes, but I want to make a couple of clarifications because of the way we're going to present this. We are also, just because it's part of the downtown branch, we're going to talk about the code of conduct that we have that we are just revising, and we're going to talk about kind of the atmosphere and what it's like in the branch. And that is not what we are not saying is you need a certain code of conduct and you have a certain behavior in the branch because there are people without homes. We are not saying that. Sometimes people put those two things together and sometimes they might slightly intersect. But it does seem important to understand what's happening, particularly at the downtown branch, and how that sets the stage for the kinds of library services we are offering a particular part of the community, people without homes. So we're not saying that this is only for that one group. I just really do want to make that clear to everyone. We have two presentations. The first one is going to be by James Lee, who's the branch manager of the downtown branch. And he's going to talk about, he worked very hard with others of his staff on a revised code of conduct. And he can give you also kind of a feel about what his job is like and what he sees. And the way I was thinking we can do this is James can present, and then if you have questions particularly of him, you could ask them then. And then Myla will talk about services to people without homes. She can present. You can ask specific questions of her, and then we can just have a general discussion of all the things that we've heard. Susan likes to refer to this as a two-pronged approach to many things, where we need to pay attention to behavior in our branches, but we need to also pay attention to information services to the people in our. And this is a good example of that. So I'd like to invite James to talk to us about being a branch manager at the downtown branch.
Good evening, all.
That's
a familiar basis for everybody to see
much lower than the number of suspensions that we've issued throughout the 5-year system. Because it's really that serious. I mean, it sounds like it. In fact, in August of 2016, there was a death threat issued for a library of that person by DT157. I won't say his name. When he made his threat, his death threat, he was told he couldn't threaten staff. He was responsible for it. It wasn't a threat, it was a promise. In May 9th of 2016, this gentleman, DTN 149, while he was serving a 60-day ban for threatening library staff, walked by the building and he to the front door shattered. It took several months to do it. Assault on library staff. In June of 2016, DTN 155 broke a rock over one of our building maintenance workers, hitting him in the ankle. Many staff seem to be suffering. Many staff seem to be suffering from stress and trauma as a result of the broad incidents that they are faced with. What's important to note here is that this is while we're trying to conduct our work. We've got really busy jobs, really important work. We're trying to provide great service to our customers. And it's really difficult to switch gears between being threatened in one moment and then trying to smile and find somebody to look down history the next. So a picture tells a thousand words. Are those just isolated incidents, or is that what we're encountering on a regular basis? Each of these photos were taken during the month of February at the downtown library. We're faced with aggression, with drug use, more drug use, more aggression. This is the YP restroom that we designate only for kids, and somebody got in there somehow and was shooting up. At 7 o'clock in the morning, when our patrons were trying to return the materials, this is the gamut that they had to walk through. Many of our complaints are indeed related to the welcomingness of our library and people's ability to access not only our resources, but also to return their items. So, to improve things, our proposal is to update the code of conduct in a way that will provide clear expectations, define prohibited behaviors, required compliance or reasonable requests, reasons that support what our expectations are, and equitable enforcement and consequences. So, in your packets, you will see that one of the documents is titled Code of Conduct for Prohibited Behaviors, and each of the rules to follow are listed in that document. So we don't want people to have to struggle with behavior. You must listen to your panhandle. Use of audible devices that interferes with someone else's enjoyment of the library. Any communication device that distracts others. Distributing the literature. Conducting surveys, soliciting contributions inside the library facility. To make ourselves to make the information, resources, and materials accessible to all, we're going to require that setting up blankets or bedding with the intention to camp or sleep anywhere on the property is prohibited. No lying down or appearing to be asleep, having food on furniture, blocking aisles, exits, or entrances. Bringing large items into the library. Currently, our code of conduct says, please refrain from bringing large items in. But that's way too subjective. So by having specific dimensions, it'll really give us a firm ground to stand on. This is actually the exact dimensions of the rolling file cabinets that are adjacent to each of the service desks. So there's a visual representation for staff to review. And actually, we're a little more gracious than the industry standard. Many locations require not to exceed 51 inches, but we know the service is a unique demographic, and we didn't want to be exclusionary. Anything that blocks aisleways, personal property, or leaving personal property unattended. To ensure a safe and secure environment, this is the long way. Roller skates, bicycles, skateboards, scooters, anything else that's a wheeled device with the exception of what's necessary for medical purposes or travel. Disciplining a child in a manner that disturbs others. Leaving children unattended. And parents are cared for not ensuring that your child follows the code of conduct. As well as adults loitering in the children's area. That's actually a California Penal Code statute. Inappropriate use of library property, grounds, or computers. engaging in activities not reasonably associated with the use of the library. The idea behind this is that we don't have to have every single possible infraction listed in our code of conduct, like keep your pants on. It should be a clear societal expectation, but this is our way of saying that even if it's not listed in the sign, I'm your sign today. Failing to comply with the request of library staff to cease behavior that interferes with the functioning of the library, or failing to leave the library during emergencies or a closed time, as well as intimidating, harassing, and threatening staff, volunteers, or patrons, being under the influence of alcohol or illegal drugs, trespassing in non-public areas, leaving the library without permission, or during a period of suspension, and engaging in other behaviors that would constitute a misdemeanor, felony, or any crime under applicable law. Lastly, maintaining a healthy and clean environment, entering into the library barefoot, without a shirt, removing footwear, or being otherwise attired to disturb or disrupt the library environment. Body odors, personal hygiene, or excessive fragrances that interfere with other patrons' ability to enjoy the library. Bringing pets or animals, other than service animals, into the new building. Littering. Using cigarettes, e-cigarettes, or any tobacco product, or cannabis. Using restrooms for bathing, shampooing, or doing laundry. Consumption of snack foods in a way that creates a mess. We're not going to clean up after yourself. We do allow eating in the library, just not under our own computers. And so I think we can all agree that these are reasonable expectations to assist the library in doing what they're doing. What else do we need? We need to provide training to staff. There's some really great tools out there, some great services and sessions that the library is looking into to ensure that the staff understands its role in enforcing the code of conduct. It's not about doing it when it feels right. It's not about doing it when it's easy. It's about doing it consistently so that you provide equitable service. So the guy in the three-piece suit has to abide by the same rules as the guy that's carrying all his belongings with him. And there are instances where people have violated the code of conduct that weren't experiencing homelessness. Most often, we find that the more enforcement of code of conduct is to the defense of those that are experiencing homelessness. They've gotten into some altercation out on the street, that follows them into the library, so it's up to us to make sure that this doesn't continue once they're in there. As well as communicate that enforcement should start as informative as opposed to punitive. Every engagement should begin with, excuse me, sir, you may not be aware. You probably didn't see the sign on your way in. So it's just let them know. And how they take that information and how what they do with that is entirely up to them. And communicate remain consistent and protect rights of all of you. When I find myself in a position to enforce the code of conduct, I'm not doing it to come down on the individual. I'm doing it to protect everybody else's rights to enjoy the library. There's some things that we're already doing. First, we have to acknowledge that there's an issue that needs to be addressed. I think that's why we're up here today. In the most recent board address by the director to the Library Joint Power Board, which indicated that downtown grounds to continue to receive complaints from the public and staff about personal safety and security. Sleeping on library grounds continues. Bystanders and their belongings often block sidewalks and entrances. Drug use occurs frequently. The report also addresses several other issues. To include consistent expectations and enforcement. On this topic, we have met with First Alarm in the city of Santa Cruz to clarify specific ordinances and expectations of enforcement. We've appointed a library representative on the Downtown Safety Committee, developed a relationship with a police liaison, and expanded our ranger services. With regard to the poor physical condition of the libraries, and some of this is actually a hot topic right now. Recently, the post office put a fence around the structure. And it's a concept called defensive architecture. Some of those strategies we're going to be implementing at the library. I have mixed feelings about this. I don't like the idea of taking away benches from people. But if those benches are constantly being occupied by people that aren't utilizing library services, then they're not serving our patrons. On the poor physical environment, they're going to be fencing in the breezeway to the parking lot with a gate. It will open during open hours, but keep closed while we're closed. Removing the benches at the library entrance, reducing the size of the bathroom stall door, and exploring additional tools such as cameras. And then lastly, limited programs and services for adults, some of which Maya is going to speak to today. So we're networking with local agencies and nonprofits to coordinate services. We're expanding the adult life skills program to include financial literacy, job search skills, medical information, and veteran services. In that most recent staff report from our library director, she made a really profound statement. That's the one thing that I want to make sure gets driven home here, is that this is not purely an issue of homelessness. Many patients that are experiencing homelessness use our library in very meaningful ways. These strategies are an attempt to manage behaviors. Sorry, you can't read it wrong. To manage the behaviors of patrons to create a respectful learning environment for all. All the information provided here was internal documentation, so the references are probably accessible for probably materials you've already seen before or would have access to. Any questions?
I have a question.
Yeah.
Well, I have several. But when you developed this revised, because the code of conduct was revised a couple of years ago, if I recall. I guess it was about 3 or 4 years ago to change the add sweeping. But it was a much shorter document.
Yes.
Did you model this revision?
We looked at four other library systems and what they had in place. Nothing here is new. Nothing that we
right.
created.
You weren't developing
anything. We looked at the Seattle Public Library, the Denver Public Library, Pima County Public Library, and Ramsey County Public Library.
And the policy applies to all the branches, obviously.
That's correct. Right. Well, that question did come up. Yeah. If we wanted to revise the code of conduct for the downtown library or for the entire system. Mm-hmm. And part of the equitability is ensuring that people follow the same rules in each branch and that people can expect the same service and same enforcement in each branch. I know that many of the scenarios that you've seen here result from the downtown library, but there was a break-in and theft at My Hope. The Half Dust Branch has dealt with people who are drinking in the building. Mm-hmm. Grants of 40 inherited many of our issues. Mm-hmm. So I'd say none of our patients are exclusive to a single grant. Yeah. They get away.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Let's
see, another. When you talk about training, in the latest issue of American Libraries, that magazine that comes from the American Library Association, the whole section, whole article, and I meant to read it tonight, on mental health training for staff.
That's something
that, yeah, go ahead. So I was wondering, you listed the different kinds of, but I'm hoping and assuming that that's...
That's one of our bullet points. The library's already invested in mental health first aid training for staff. And it's a deep-pocket investment. Oftentimes, staff trainings are available to regular or rather permanent staff. This particular training is open to all. So our on-calls, our aides, anyone that works in the libraries was welcome to attend on day time.
And one of our staff has become certified by the state to do the training. We actually partner with a staff member of Watsonville Public Library, and they offer the trainings to both systems together.
Then I have one more question. When we look to the future for designing a new downtown grant, whether it's in the existing space or in a new space, I'm hoping there are ways that we can design the building in such a way that we can serve all of our patrons at whatever socioeconomic level they're at right now the downtown ranch is not a really great building to begin. It doesn't look good, it's not a very inviting place regardless of the issues that you're raising. And I'm hoping that we'll learn as we plan for the downtown branch that from other urban libraries, that there's ways we can build a library that will help us mitigate some of these behavioral issues but still provide services that are...
There's a lot of work we've done in designing architecture that will do exactly those things, urban architecture, urban libraries, and we're going to look at all of those.
Okay.
things. We're going to do a big investigation. We're going to try to figure out where we'll work in Santa Cruz.
Mm-hmm. How much collaboration do you have with county and city mental health departments?
Some departmental help, but most of our collaboration is with other local nonprofit agencies. Currently, our Encompass social worker is at downtown library. She's got regular office hours down there. She's always been at our disposal, so when we call regularly, it's great to know that she'll be there at certain times, certain days of the week. As far as collaboration with city and county mental health agencies, I'm actually designated on the safety committee. And there are representation there from all departments. It's a city committee, but most recently our guest speaker was the chief medical officer for Santa Cruz County.
And are you working with the different homeless centers also? I know the United Way has a whole project going on.
Myler will talk a little bit.
Okay.
We did recently open our doors to the Homeless Services Center. They offer some housing navigation services. Since they've had some restructuring, they decided to centralize all the services that they're providing. So now, as opposed to meeting at the library, they're meeting their clients at their location. But they were our parent ever since I've been there.
How did that work for you? I mean, how did that work?
Originally, they didn't have a dedicated place. They just met in the had some tables in the public area. But after seeing the work that they were doing, after our volunteer meeting room, because it wasn't being used at the time that they were meeting with us. So they appreciated it, but it only lasted a short time based on where they were in their transition.
Is that something that you see might be helpful in the future, to have dedicated space for other staff, not library staff, but, you know, county, city staff who are...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, you're in the offer of someone halfway out of the situation that they're in, I totally support it.
Yeah.
It's just that. Is it going to be a crutch to allow someone to continue living in that situation, or is it going to be a pathway out? One of the goals is to transform lives. And I think the population experiencing homelessness are in the greatest position to have their lives transformed. I've seen success stories. In the library system I came from, we adopted a much more comprehensive security process, very similar to what we're proposing here. And it took a lot of staff buy-in. It also took a lot of the public education to what our expectations were. But in no time at all, it was the people that we originally had contacts with that were helping us to enforce our code. They were sharing the word, hey, you can't do that. And there's something about being consistent and having those conversations with people who work friends. And it becomes clear that that's just the standard expectation. No one's picking on an individual. We're protecting them.
Well, I just want to say that I really think this is a great presentation, and I learned a lot. And, going through that code of conduct, it just seems so well thought out. Like, there was a tremendous amount of,
It was definitely a group effort.
Yeah.
I worked on this, actually, let me give some credit to the folks that aren't here today. Sarah Harbison, one of our librarians, spearheaded this with me. We presented to our fellow grant managers, and at the same time, went out to the reference team. So lots of people have the opportunity to contribute, to clarify things, to tweak different wordings. But I think we've been really comprehensive. And what's important to me is, so I've been through some really good trainings on what's called backup librarianship. It's not what it sounds like. There's no Taekwondo at all. It's about your approach. It's about making sure you keep yourself safe and that you protect your patrons at the same time. And I got to say that what they're looking for in your security plan is for it to be didactic, for it to be transparent. There shouldn't be some hidden clause in there that where you trip people up.
Yeah.
There shouldn't be something language in there that makes it unclear. So what I really like about the version we've come up with is that our roles are repeated over and over again for each of the prohibited behaviors. So if you do something that prevents the library from performing this role, or something that prevents our patrons from enjoying this about the library, that's the behavior that we're trying to do.
I have one more question, sort of an aesthetic question. When, I guess you're going to be fencing the Freezeway, is it going to be, I mean, right now the post office, I mean, it just looks horrible, and it looks so negative. You know, what's the plan for how that's going to...
We're currently wrought iron fencing on the library property as well.
Oh, I guess
that existing material.
Uh-huh.
It's just the area that
walks out. So there's a gate. That's sort of basically a gate.
That's right.
Yeah.
We'll open and close that gate.
Because you already have a wall. I mean, you already have a wall between the breezeway and the parking lot.
Right.
So it's basically a gate.
That's correct. Yeah. Well, they're going to build up the gate on the wall itself.
They're going to build up.
As well as build a fence. There's still a wrought iron fence along the wall, and then a gate at each end.
Uh-huh.
That's where we're experiencing the lion's share of our employees.
Okay,
The wall itself is actually providing some seclusion for people, so they can kind of do whatever they want behind the wall. But if they can't get behind the wall, then hopefully that won't happen. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. So James and his staff and the whole staff are looking at ways to structure a safe, welcoming environment and to make everyone aware of the behaviors that are expected in the library. And then Miley group for today is thinking about the information needs, particularly of people without homes. And she began in a very small way by looking for information and has developed into this pretty amazing thing. So Miley, would you like us to hand it out for you?
Or you are living in somewhere that is not fit for human habitation.
on the street in a bad building, then you are federally defined as homeless. What it doesn't include is people who are doubled up, couch surfing, over occupancy, who may become homeless at some point. But it's not included in the federal definition. How do we know what we know about homelessness? In San Andreas, we participate in a point-in-time survey. This is a special kind of data gathering that is dictated by the head of the house, Department of Housing and Urban Development. And it's administered locally by the Homeless Action Partnership and Applied Survey Research. Basically, it's a big Blitz count. It's an observational count that's done in January every 2 years. And a bunch of volunteers go out and survey neighborhoods and observe what they're seeing. We're trained. I participated this year, so I have a little better understanding of it. You're trained to kind of look for signs. You don't actually go up and talk to people. That's considered invasive. There are these surveys that are follow-up surveys with people one-on-one. And then the more detailed knowledge and demographic information is gotten from those surveys. But the count is done all in one day, and this year it was January 23rd. So the last PIT survey we had is from 2015, and we will have data again in May or June of this year. What do we know from this data? One of the biggest myths that we have in town is that most people who are homeless in San Francisco came from somewhere else. You probably heard that over and over again. They're transients, they're just here for the services. What the data shows year after year is that that's not so. 84% were residents in San Francisco County when they became homeless, and the largest percentage of that number lived in San Francisco for 10 years or more prior to becoming homeless. We also have a transient rate. I mean, we've heard that word transient sort of gets applied to sort of mean the lowest of the low, right? They're transients. They came from somewhere else, and they're not even San Francisco residents. And yet, we have the same percentage of transient homelessness as other counties in California. Myth number two, most people who are homeless in San Francisco are making a lifestyle choice. They don't want to be housed. Actually, if you ask people, 86% say, yes, they would want to be housed, especially if it was affordable and permanent. Myth number three, most people who are homeless have a severe mental illness. Well, mental illness is definitely an intersecting issue with homelessness. We know this. And yet, it is not as huge as we assume. The national data says that mental illness affects about 13-15% of the national homeless population. Our PIT survey doesn't have enough data to get at this number totally, absolutely, for standards, which is why I'm using the national data that is claimed. Has some pretty reliable data and talks about this issue over and over again as sort of the authority on it. And even his data shows that amongst chronically homeless, which is the most visible, that percentage is higher, 30-40%. And I think that often what we're dealing with at Santa Cruz Public Library downtown is much more of the percentage of chronic homelessness in Santa Cruz. Homeless people don't work. Actually, they do. According to national data, 45% of homeless adults have worked in the past 30 days, which is really only a few percentage points different than the data for people who are housed. If you could count off the book work or exchange or sometimes people volunteer at a shelter and get food or services in kind, if you could count that, then that percentage would be even higher. What is the PIT survey showing us? Well, it looks like we are doing a good job decreasing homelessness. For the last 10 years, the numbers have been going up and down, but we saw a very big decrease last time the survey was done. Why? Well, we think it has to do with a huge paradigm shift in how we think about this issue. Housing First started being utilized in different ways in Santa Cruz, not necessarily in a coordinated effort or coordinated movement, but in different ways that I'll talk about. Over the last several years, we've been seeing a much more housing first approach. Do folks know what that is, what housing first is? So the old idea was the person had to be made housing ready, they had to show that they had dealt with all of their issues, their tickets are all taken care of, and they're in support for before they can be ready to get housed. And Housing First is showing us that actually if you house people and then give them the wraparound support to make those life changes, it's cheaper and more effective. Billy Miller Murray is an article that appeared in the New Yorker, Malcolm Gladwell. It's one of his kind of initial big articles, and I've given it to you in your packets because it kind of is a nice introduction to Housing First. It's focused on Reno, Nevada, but it's interesting to read that sort of initial article sort of work within the Housing First approach. It's a paradigm shift, and studies are showing that if we can harness a truly Housing First approach, we can save a lot of money. We save from Los Angeles. It costs about 5 times less to plan people in supported housing than to continuously pay for emergency services, hospitalizations, law enforcement. We also have an economic roundtable that studied this phenomenon in Santa Clara, very close to us. So it's not just in Utah that we've been able to use a Housing First approach. They did this study with 103 persistently homeless people and found the savings to be about $42,000 per year per person. It doesn't happen overnight, though. We're kind of in the midst of a shift right now. I think that that's part of the uptick in different kinds of issues we're seeing downtown. But we have started on this road, and we've made certain changes in the way we're approaching this issue. 2 years ago, the Home Services Center lost the huge national grant that they used to have every year. And they went to a different way of funding, which involves these target funding streams. They have to show specific outcomes for specific target populations. They have to show that they're moving into housing. So one of the ironies of Housing First is so the data is showing us that this works, and yet how do we get from here to here? At the federal level, they took all the funding out of the emergency service bucket and put it into Housing First. Now you have to show that you're doing Housing First and you're moving people into housing and creating pathways. And yet, we still have a need for emergency services. HSC used to have a big open campus. They used to feed people and do meals every day. They're still doing some of that, but they have a much more elaborate intake process, which I think is creating barriers for some. And they have a locked campus, so you have to show A, B, and C, and you have to agree with this, this, and this. And yes, we're seeing a change in the downtown. So that's kind of the context that I think we are seeing right now. It's hopeful in that we have this pathway forward. We can be part of the shift to Housing First in Santa Cruz. I think we have a huge role to play as a hub in garnering partners and helping people move and find pathways to housing. But right now we're kind of in this weird phase where we haven't, like, the pathway isn't really mapped out, or the roadmap is there, but we don't really have all the infrastructure in place. If you fit certain criteria, if you're a single mom, you'll probably get a bed at the Reveille Family Shelter, and you'll probably eventually get a voucher. But vouchers are also, there's just a very huge lack of affordable housing. So even folks that have the voucher are waiting a very, very long time in the temporary shelter to get moved into permanent housing. So we're kind of like at this crucial moment where we see the way forward, but we don't have all the road isn't built yet. So how can the library fit in? Libraries democratize access to information and expertise. That's a quote I heard actually firsthand. I heard you say that in a workshop, and it just kind of rang this bell for me, like, that's a nice, succinct way of saying something I've always talked about why I do this. And yet, yeah, I had never heard it so succinctly or so critically. And as we know, people experiencing homelessness end up at the library. The library is open to everyone. They end up there whether or not they feel welcome. And I think whether or not they feel welcome is a big part of the behavior that we then implement this. People experiencing homelessness have many, many information needs. I mean, I started building this outreach program partly because I was also concerned about some of the issues that James was bringing up. And I was wondering if we changed the atmosphere, if we if we did some direct outreach, if we could just sort of indirectly change some of the behaviors we're seeing by reaching out and change, maybe not with, you know, certain individuals, but by changing a sort of an atmospheric effect. If you feel like it's your living room, you're not going to go to the bathroom on the floor, you know. So that's not going to change for everyone. The people have all kinds of crazy stuff going on in their lives, but I think if you could change an overall atmosphere, then you create allies and partners in enforcing how we act in this space. Similarly to how San Francisco Public built the HASA program, Health and Safety Advocates, they built that over time. It took 5 years. But they created a program in which they have people with lived experience in homelessness go through a training program and then become advocates for the library. So they are the first line of defense. If someone is misusing restroom facilities, a HASA advocate goes up and talks to them. And it's a different relationship that then happens as a result of that conversation versus a security guard or staff member. That is an outcome I would love to see the outreach program I'm running on Thursday to eventually grow into. It just takes a long time to build those partnerships. So people experiencing homelessness have all kinds of information needs, and yet they're often not asking for help. They're not necessarily coming up to the reference desk and saying, hey, you know, I have to get this food stamp application in by Thursday or else I lose my access. Can you help me with that? I don't understand this website. Can you help me? They're not doing that. Why? Why aren't they doing that? Their information needs are probably even more emergency oriented than the rest of us, and yet they're not asking for help. Well, these guys in Canada have studied that phenomenon. In Community-Led Libraries Toolkit, they talk about social exclusion. And when you really study how people information seek when they feel socially excluded, you come up with a whole set of, you know, different ways that people act when they don't feel like that's their place. If I don't feel like I can go up to the reference desk and get good service, most of us assume if we go up to the car dealership or we go to the library, we go to the hardware store and we go to the person and we say, I need this tool, I don't know what it looks like, but it's supposed to help me with, you know, fixing my sink, and I think it goes on, and it all sounds dumb, but I know I'm going to get help, right? But somebody who is experiencing homelessness, someone who is in the category of social exclusion, is not necessarily going to believe that they will get that help. And they might actually have an experience that makes them feel even more helpless or even more ashamed. It was interesting for me that we all kind of intuitively know that, but this is the research that shows that that is so. So when you feel socially excluded, you feel really anxious about making appointments or visiting government agencies or walking up and asking for help. You often don't want to go with you. You need to know ahead of time, you need to have heard by word of mouth that something good will come of that. Someone else in your situation has tried it out. Okay, so then they came up with a statement. Libraries have to recognize that same or consistent customer service, which does not take into account socioeconomic disparity, results in inequitable services that further disadvantage socially excluded people. So if you take that into consideration when you're planning a service or an outreach program, how do you do it? How do you build it so that it creates that trust? So I didn't know how to do this. But I tried to follow the community-led approach, which was basically talking and talking and talking with a lot of people before doing anything. I started going out there on Thursdays and just checking in with people, and the first time I did that, I was so afraid. I thought that it would seem so patronizing, or they would be mad at me, and instead I was totally welcomed. And they were surprised that I was looking them in the eye and asking them what kind of library service they wanted. I started with just the folks hanging out in front of the library. And I got all kinds of different ideas from folks about what kind of service they might like. And we started, the strategic planning process began, and so I kept going out there and I asked if I could bring coffee, and yep, so I started bringing coffee, and then I started looking around at other libraries and noticing that their community engagement initiatives with people experiencing homelessness also often started with a coffee hour. And these are a sampling of some of the other libraries that are pursuing different kinds of social services. service engagement programming. There's some photos from Job Members, Job Resource Center, and Dallas Public Library has a really innovative set of programs. That's the coffee hour. We also have an art program, a photography outreach program where they give people cameras and ask them to document their day. Seattle Public Library has outreach programs that connect youth to social service agencies. And here's a few pieces of data about how many youth experiencing homelessness in Santa Cruz, 29%. And also a large percentage former foster care, because so much of what you're seeing when you're homeless is that you don't have social resources, you don't have family resources to fall back on homeless because they were kicked around all these different. And one of the folks that's been using the program since October is former foster care, and he's aged out. So they even have some extension services now from 18 to 24. But once you're older than 24, the national data shows us that it could be up to 40% of homeless youth have an LGBT identification and were either runaways or kicked out. And Sass Price Lowry's story is really, really powerful. And basically what she's saying there is, I needed to know that I could survive this. And so part of what I want the outreach program to be is sort of building the community, building a community of both housed neighbors, downtown neighbors, staff at the library, and people with lived experience of homelessness who then support each other to move out of this situation and find pathways. But it has to start with trust. So I've been holding the coffee hour, the first hour, 9 to 10, in a little alcove on Church and Center. That's the It's where the leftover murals from Bridget Henry's show still say home. And so it's sort of an attempt to make that real. And we started out with about 8 to 12 people at first. And now we're seeing, like 20 to 40 people cycle through between 9 and 10. And the outreach about the second hour, during that first hour, we built very strong partnerships with Chris Youngbrick, who comes to every Thursday. And she has told me over and over again that it's been very successful for uniting her with several of the people that she needs to be in touch with on a weekly basis. And then we've also been partnering with Homeless Persons Health Project. They've been sending often a nurse or RN or one of their interns to the coffee hour. And then we're building connections with other organizations as well. I would love to have this really touch lots of different community organizations and have them use the Thursday group for outreach about their own services so we could be a connection point. This is some of the interim outcomes. So we've only been going with the second hour of information navigation. So basically when people told me all different things about what they needed. I need to make a phone call so I can get my instrument out of storage because that's how I earn my living and my friend has it in the storage but I can't get it because I don't have a phone. My phone got stolen. And you hear all these different things and not necessarily is the person saying, I have to find housing for tonight. They're often seeing their predicament in different ways. So I thought, well, let's design what is essentially a reference appointment and allow the person to ask us, tell us what they need to work on. And then we facilitate. So they work one-on-one with a librarian staff member or increasingly we have a cohort of 6 volunteers who are learning the information navigation role to the extent that they feel comfortable. So if it's really a simple thing like setting up an email, they can sit with a community member and set up an email account. If it's something a little more difficult, then we'll pair them with a staff member. They have access to a free phone line, free scanning, and printing. We've done a bunch of different housing applications and got people on waiting lists, and we've heard back from 2 people that they did get housing. We've helped people apply for the Lifeline phone. We've assisted with connecting people to the Homeless Persons Health Project for medical and also mental health issues. We've done lots and lots of email, recovering lost accounts, setting up an account. Verifying, there's a step for most email accounts now where you have to verify on some kind of phone, another phone. So if you don't have one, this program helps you get that step done. Also, Chris Youngman is always there, and she can immediately set people up with a HSC PO box, which gets you started on a lot of different things. That's a big stumbling block for people. And then Homeward Bound, if it pertains to you, if you can show proof of residence somewhere else in some other county, anywhere in the U.S., and that person can be gotten on the phone and verify, yes, you will have a place to stay if you can send him here. Homeward Bound sends him home with a free bus ticket. And Chris can make that happen like that afternoon. So that's kind of amazing. And we've seen that happen. We've seen that happen with a gentleman who at first was just trying to use his own family resources, and then that ticket got stolen. He came back to the program. Chris got on that bus that afternoon. We've also assisted with resumes, cover letters, job applications. And we've heard back from two participants that they did successfully land that job. We've also been doing a lot of computer literacy, helping with Word, Excel, Google Docs, Craigslist ads, all that kind of stuff. And then here are some of the things we've connected. These are just organizations we've connected people to. We're often helping people find an NA or AA meeting, or Refuge Recovery is a group we've learned about that's not a 12-step group, but it is also a recovery, addiction recovery organization. What are some of the bigger picture things that we're hoping? We're hoping that this program, as it slowly builds up, will create empowerment for the public, for staff, and for people experiencing homelessness. That we will be contributing to a safer library for everyone. That we will be building opportunities for all of us to experience human dignity as a community, as a community definition, because I think part of the polarization is caused by it hurts all of us to see someone on the street who, doesn't have access to a public restroom or a shower. Like, when we have a few of those resources, but it's actually when you really get down to it and you're trying to help someone navigate or get ready for a job application, you realize how few those resources are. I mean, we have this idea that all these services, but it's actually when you look at who qualifies for what and where it is and how they have to get from here to here, and it's not all of these, right? You see the limitation. I would love for this program to be a jumping off point. We're talking about creating a series of forums for the general public next fall. We're partnering with Smart Solutions and the IHR, the Institute for Humanities Research at UCSD, to try to bring a number of different researchers, policy analysts, and also people with lived experience to create a set of forums that would actually, be able to debate this issue and solutionary, we call it, create a space for collaboration and really looking at how we as a community are going to solve this issue. And we have the all-in plan also as a roadmap. The all-in plan is our 10-year plan in homelessness, and it actually is pretty detailed. There's a lot of really great data and analysis in that plan. I think one of the weaknesses is there is no appointed entity that's in charge of implementation and no appointed funding. But we have this roadmap. So I think that's one of the ways in which the library can actually help play a coalescing role. Because we have this roadmap, we can help educate about it, and we can help create space for figuring out how we're going to implement that plan. And I leave you with this quote from Martin Luther King, letter from the Birmingham jail, in which he defines the garment of destiny, the inescapable network of mutuality, that our outcomes are tied to everyone else's, our dignity is tied to other people's dignity, and our potential is tied to everyone's potential. We're interrelated, we're interdependent. I think it's really important on this issue. Here's some other resources. I can send you the slides if you're interested. Questions?
Well, I would definitely like it if you could send the slides.
Yeah, I will definitely send them.
That would be great. I have a question. At the beginning, you talked about the definition of homelessness. How does that, and I couldn't read all of the details, but there's a large segment of the homeless population that lives in their cars, or sometimes in mobile homes and RVs. So
yeah.
How does that fit into the overall definition?
That those are considered homeless.
Okay.
So yes, that if you're living in your vehicle, you are federally defined as homeless. And the Pitt Survey does teach volunteers how to count that. So that was in one of the census tracts that I had as a volunteer this year. We were going through like Nobel, that area kind of below UCSC, and I was surprised at how many vehicles were fitting the description of someone sleeping there. But you could see like bedding in there, and you could see the fogged windows, and you could see, you know, one little
crack. Students.
Exactly. And in fact, when I talked with the IHR about partnering, they were very concerned about bringing that issue in because that's kind of a hidden population that is just, you know, not seen, not talked about, and yet there is a large student population that is, that's their solution to the high cost of education, I guess, is they're sleeping in their cars.
Other questions? My mind is spinning. It's a lot of good information. So do you see the same population coming every Thursday to the downtown?
No, I'm seeing really different
mm-hmm.
groups. I mean, there's a little bit of a core group, but not as much as I expected. And often I'm seeing people come up and start using the program, and I'm sort of like thinking that they're a neighbor maybe that's exploring it, and maybe they're, and then I find out after talking to them that they're sleeping in a vehicle, or, you know, they just don't fit, they don't look homeless, they, you know, look clean and cut, and yet they are also, and so they're looking for something in that second hour that they heard about the program. And so it's been pretty, I've been on a huge learning curve myself, just trying to design something substantive. And I hope, I don't think we're anywhere near where we need to be, but I think we're at a good starting point. I would love to see, I'm looking at talking to the day center about, I would love to see us evolve to the point where we can actually be, you know, I have lots of folks that say they want to help with cleaning up. Like, you know, there's, you hear from people experiencing homelessness the concern about the trash and about, you know, it's, there's division in that community too. And, you know, there's safety concerns in that community. They don't have access to law enforcement the same way that you and I can call the phone, pick up the phone and dial 911. And so I would love to see a cohort form that is sort of dedicated to
one in San Francisco.
Yeah, it's dedicated to kind of changing the atmosphere downtown and sort of compassionate enforcement of, you know, code of conduct. And
have you noticed any kind of correlation between incidents in the downtown library and your program yet? Or I mean, just because of sort of relationships you're developing with certain people?
I thought, well, no, I mean, I haven't done any kind of data crunching like that, but I had thought that I would have to do a lot more enforcement of, like, because I track all the bands that come through too, so that I, you know, I have to say on Thursday if somebody comes that's banned, I'm sorry, but you can't. But I've only had two in the whole time. There's only been two that where I had to say, I'm sorry, but, you know, you can come back after, blah, blah, blah. So it's not necessarily the same crew.
I think it's interesting what you're saying. It's almost like they want it, but the people who are coming want it to succeed.
They do, yeah. And they and they're very aware of the way that homelessness is perceived and the way they're lumped in with someone who's showing up in the bathroom. And yeah, there's...
So it's almost like a self-policing in a way.
And that's what I hope to, like, I hope to see that, you know, have ripple effects outwards, because I think when you create a sense of welcome and a sense of, yeah, this is my place, I don't have to just, you know, I'm not being articulate, but I think you can do that. I think you can shift assumptions about a place based on, you know, creating a sort of critical mass of, you know, with enough people who feel like, hey, this is a good thing we got here. This is a good place. Let's not mess it up. With enough of that, you can create self-policing behavior in a larger community. So.
And you talked a little bit about bringing together, community members who are housed with community members who aren't. And I think that is a really effective way of educating most of us who are housed about what's going on, but also just to see each other as real human beings that have histories and backgrounds and have families and have stories to tell. So are there any programming opportunities that you've been thinking about to have the library engage the whole community in these sort of civic conversations and learning experiences?
Yeah, well, like I was saying, we're partnering with Smart Solutions and the Institute for Humanities Research and hoping to bring other partners into it. We're planning a planning meeting for April to invite a bunch of different stakeholders to help us with what we hope will be a 14-month series that will host a series of different events at least once a month or so. We'll have to see how the logistics work, but some of them much bigger and maybe off-site, not all of them at the library, but IHR is working on bringing Matthew Desmond, who's a researcher from Harvard who studied eviction in Milwaukee. And
about the book, Evicted.
Evicted, uh-huh.
Huge.
Yeah, so some big names like that. Don Lane knows Dennis Culhane, who did all the research on mental health national statistics, and we're working on bringing him. And then coupling some of those big researchers, so sort of more famous researchers in the field, with folks from the advocacy community, from the social service community, and then also from the activist community. I would love to get all the different stakeholders in the room, and with probably a professional facilitation team, so that we can deal effectively with, some of the real hard stuff that comes out. I was just at Community Conversations Forum this Saturday, which became a little bit of a polarized atmosphere, and felt like I learned how I might want to do that differently. But.
I was thinking that one kind of program that might be really useful is, and I know there are people in the Santa Cruz area who can facilitate this very well, but having homeless people and housed people together in a program and have them write their stories and then read their stories. So, because I really think that once you see somebody as a real person, it just changes everything.
Yeah.
Not just your ability to perceive that one individual, but it changes your perception of the whole population.
Yeah. So Annette March is going to be part of our planning committee, and she did the series called Not the Other, which I don't know if you want to watch those, but it's one of the links on the end of the presentation. Those are really powerful because she goes around and interviews for a short amount of time people experiencing homelessness, and those are really effective. And the photographs that I'm using in the presentation are from a Florida project called Rethink Homelessness, where they handed people a cardboard, people on the street, a piece of cardboard, and said, write something on there that you think people wouldn't know or expect about you. And so she wrote, I was a figure skater, I was, and that helps contextualize too, that, there's all these different stories.
Following up on that, what Barbara was saying, is that the article that was in the Sentinel on New Year's Day about this program, and I know that's when you solicited for volunteers to help on Thursdays, and I've been a volunteer with that. You do get a chance to talk to people. I've been impressed that since Thursdays mornings, it starts at 9 o'clock, and if you go by the library, you'll see that everybody, they've all sort of cleared out and they're all ready. There's a lot of respect for this already, even though it's only been you know, not even
they're often picking up trash and getting the space ready, and then
I think that's really, I mean, there's a lot of respect for what in the community, for what in that, in the people who are experiencing homelessness in that community for white people. So I'm kind of hope, I mean, after what we heard Jane say about, you know, the problems that indisputably are happening down there, if we can somehow get the two, get a more positive outcome. And maybe again, the building, having a new building that will be designed in such a way that you can do both things would be really good.
How do you see all of this information you're gathering and developing and programs and stuff transferring out to the other branches? Homelessness is all over the county.
Yeah.
And I know that, I know Brent's 40 has an issue, but I know it's cropped up in other libraries, so how can all this information you're doing and gathering, because other homeless areas in the county, they have different issues sometimes. Mm-hmm. They're country, they're maybe living rurally, homeless, and isolated, and so how, I was just wondering how you're thinking of pushing that out to other branches.
Well, I love that this question is coming up because so far it's been, it's not been the easiest start, you know, I've been trying to design something that is substantive and will have outcomes and can show that it's effective. And so the more that we can show that downtown, I think that builds the impetus to then take it elsewhere. We're also a little bit struggling with some of the IT issues right now. We really could use more laptops, and we're waiting for that to happen. But I can see that I would love to be able to bring this in, and I would love for there to be right now. At first, I had staff that I had two amazing helpers who were basically kind of just really wanted to do it, were kind of doing it on their own time, and then I advocated for, wait, can they get some hours? And yeah, so it's all just sort of like we're building the thing as we're flying it. But as long as we can get the infrastructure and the training underneath it, I would love to see it expand and move out to different branches and really learn what the issues are of that branch and that community and how to shape it and, you know, tailor it so that it is doing what it needs to do in that community.
Yeah, I would definitely second Nancy's suggestion, because while some branches may not have the same issues that downtown does as far as, you know, patrons feeling uncomfortable accessing or even having, you know, large numbers of homeless people around the library, the community has that issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so it may be more of an outreach kind of approach in some communities, as opposed to downtown having the services, you know, at the library makes a lot of sense.
And I think we have, like, there's a little bit of an organizational hurdle to overcome, but I think we're slowly overcoming it. But, you know, sometimes staff has, I came from the programming team, and I saw myself as trying to design an effective program, and yet staff are experiencing lots of issues that are creating exhaustion and overwhelm, and seeing that as the way that they're intersecting with homelessness. And so there's been a tendency to kind of see this program as though it's not validating staff experience. Like, why would you welcome more homeless people to downtown? That's the whole problem. You know? So I think we're trying to, I need to have more opportunities to engage with staff and talk about what I hope is that this program helps support and take pressure off the desk and the floor, so that there's a real place to go to address some of, you know, the toughest issues. And we're developing this community that can help, you know, create pathway housing and connect people to social services. And we're also inviting Chris to have office hours, and we're hopefully, you know, going to do a similar thing with County Mental Health Services if we can. So we're trying to, I want to be able to contextualize it for staff so that they see that it's not like either or,
before. It's like we're trying to, you know, so we all have to work together so that we can make the situation better. So.
At our last meeting, when we talked about what the commission could be doing and helping the library staff and Susan and, you know, sort of the sounding board and coaching and all that, she talked then about it's programming for adult life skills, and it may not be just people experiencing homelessness. I mean, it could be other marginalized communities, you know, people leaving, aging out of foster care. Maybe they're housed, but don't have the skills or the knowledge. I mean, how do we reach people who are more marginalized and give them the information, resources that would help them advance in whatever work they are? And that might have some more application in some of the branches. Mm-hmm. You know, beyond just the people experiencing homelessness.
Yeah, I could certainly see that in senior.
Yeah.
Age groups, making transitions, and maybe living alone and all of that.
Yeah, it may be that at a different branch or in a different community, we wouldn't necessarily call it the same thing.
Right.
We might target it to a different, to a specific community in a certain way. And in fact, I've had suggestions from some of the branch managers not to call it people experiencing homelessness, not to it. But on the other hand, I mean, I'm still debating about that. And I'm talking with volunteers and trying to figure out what is the right path forward, because I do think there's some usefulness to directing a program to that target population and trying to create a sense of welcome. We have targeted programs to youth and teens and seniors, and this is kind of our first stab at trying to do something substantive with this particular population. But on the other hand, if someone comes in, we've had people coming in, and I've welcomed people from all walks of life.
You're not asking that.
We have a passing door, like, can you come? You don't have this option. and in fact, we've had very low barriers, so we have had no intake process. And now we're trying to think about, Jesse and I are thinking about having an intake form so that we can track outcomes. But I'm weighing that too, because I see how there's a lot of mistrust of between folks experiencing homelessness and social services. And so one of the ways I think that we're actually making some inroads is that we are not social services, we're librarians, and we're this weird thing. And so people are using it and appreciating it that there isn't a big long form they have to fill out to go and make a phone call. And yet we want to be able to capture outcomes and be able to pick up where we left off with someone. And so, we're looking at that and what's going to be best.
Well, I think you've made amazing progress in the amount of time that you've been focused on. So, really, congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm impressed with all the work that's going on here. I think, Jan, as you said, it's a two-pronged approach. And I think, there's obviously some really smart and people that are working on this.
And I can see that all the partnerships that you've already formed, that could just completely take off. Because in order for it to really work, people can't be in their own little silos and do their own thing. Mm-hmm. It's like everybody has to be overlapping all the time and bringing in new organizations and groups. And it looks like you're well on the way. And I see how in other areas in the county, how that would really vary the partners would, but that would be exciting, because I think you'd know who you were looking for.
And you do have to do both. You have to make the atmosphere safe.
Right.
And make the outcome.
That's right. And I think for us as on the commission, having this information makes it easier for us to talk about it to both aspects.
Mm-hmm.
Reassuring people that they can come to a safe environment, but also telling about the stories, the success stories about
it. And if you like, I can make sure that both James and Miley, if their presentation is available to you, I can email them. Because they both had detail in there that you might be interested in.
Yeah, it is a real issue, you know, these two things, like mm-hmm. trying to mm-hmm. get them to work, you know, and what, yay.
Just real quick, these two concepts aren't diametrically
opposed. No.
I think the outcomes that Miley's rolling for, we've already seen.
Yeah.
Knowing people by name, having a compassionate approach. And, you know, it's from your friends outside today. I mean, just stay away because I don't want you to have to go outside.
Yeah, knowing that by name is fabulous.
Really, really egregious offenders. People that know they broke the rules and can't come back to the library will run to our defense when they see somebody mouthing off because they know that our approach is one of respect. So when somebody gives us a hard time, they shut them down. So it's that type of thing that is actually growing, but it's only because the approach has to, the training for staff has to be that your approach has to be respectful. It's got to be informative to start. So yeah, I strongly support this book.
Yeah, they're good supports for each other because they're helping each other get going in the same direction.
Yeah, and I like the way, at least with Thursday Coffee, that you just sort of did it. It wasn't like you had some big thing that you had to, it wasn't going to cost a ton of money.
So it wasn't going to cost
it. So you had to go and get some approval from the powers that be. It was just like, well, let's just do it and see what happens. I think that approach is so good because then it either works and grows and becomes something significant, or it doesn't. And then you can just wither away.
And it starts with listening. The first thing she did is go out and listen. Yeah. And James did the same thing.
Yeah.
What do we need here?
Yeah.
So that's our presentation next month.
I think that needs to go further to other audiences.
We're ready.
Next
month we're going to do STEAM programs where you're going to actually get to play.
What's it STEAM?
That will be the next topic. But please, if you contact me, contact James, contact Marla directly, and thank you for listening. We really appreciate being on your podcast.
Thank you. Yeah. And if you have ideas for me or James or anybody, it's an evolving thing, so.
We know where to find you.
So I think we are ready to adjourn until April 17th, 6:30 at the downtown.
I actually made a mistake at Scotts Valley.
No,
next one.
Oh, it's Scotts Valley. All right. Thank you.